Hello and welcome to Crafty Hands Club podcast. I am your host, Carice Jefferson. This podcast talks candidly about all things jewelry making, including tips, techniques, trends, the latest industry news, traditions, self-care, and more. If you're listening for the first time, please subscribe to receive latest episode alerts. Crafty Hands Club can also be found on various social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube. Feel free to like, follow, or subscribe at any time.
Hello, hello. You are now listening to the Crafty Hands Club podcast. And today I have a wonderful guest. And just a little bit about today's guest. They have done some remarkable things, some great things in the jewelry making space, just in the creative space, period. Our guest today started a chain mail and explored that whole arena from teaching classes to having their own business and serving as a community hub here in Chicago. And from that formed many opportunities, many fans from around the world, and yes, around the world. And she also went on to create kids' toys and so forth. So ladies and gentlemen, listening for the first time, you're definitely in for a treat this episode. The guest of honor for today is Miss Rebecca Mojica, owner and founder of Blue Buddha Boutique. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Carice.
Yeah, not a problem. So is it anything you want to say to the listeners, like a quick hello or...
Well, hey guys, thank you for joining the podcast, and I'm excited to answer the questions, and hopefully you'll learn something new about me or my business today.
Wonderful. So, Rebecca, I'm just going to ask you about, in terms of how you came across chainmail, because usually when we hear chainmail, we think of medieval times, we think of Renaissance fairs, and we think of it as manly, you know, like it's a man's world. And even though more and more women over the years have gotten into chainmail and are some serious mailers, but you're considered like one of the early women that got into this whole arena. Like, can you tell listeners about your journey and the formation of that? Like, what intrigued you?
So it's funny that you mentioned Renaissance fairs, because that's actually how I got into chainmail. I was in Germany at the time. I was there for about a year as a nanny and attended a Renaissance fair around the corner from my house. And I saw someone there wearing a chainmail belt, and she was one of the attendees. It was like almost like a belly dance style with like hanging chains and beads, and it was so beautiful. There was nobody there selling them, so I went to the internet, like, okay, well, what can I find here? And I found a few belts, but none of them that really spoke to me, and I figured if I was gonna spend, you know, this much money on something that's handmade, I really want it to be something I love. But then I saw on eBay somebody selling 1,000 jump rings, make your own chainmail. So I was like, okay, I'll just give that a try. And so I ordered this package of 1,000 rings. They turned out to be galvanized steel, which is incredibly difficult to work with. I didn't have pliers. I had wrenches from my toolbox, and so I would use those to maneuver and manipulate the jump rings. And I wound up making a belt, and it was the historic European 4-in-1 pattern, but I didn't know that at the time. You know, I had hanging chains on it, and I loved it. And then I thought, well, let me make another one. And so I had enough rings left over to make a second belt. And at that point I was really hooked. So then I had my leftover rings and I'm like, what else can I do with this? And I wound up taking a class at a local bead shop to learn how to forge a clasp, you know, do some wire wrap, which I'd never done before, for the belt. And they actually offered chainmail classes there too. So I took a couple there, and then it turned out the instructor was leaving, like moving to North Carolina or something. And I was like, oh, well, does the bead shop need a new chainmail instructor? And she's like, oh yeah. She's like, you actually know everything that I know and more. So yeah, I'm happy to put in a recommendation for you. And so that's when I was like, oh boy, I better get my butt in gear. And that's really when, you know, things really started to take off for me.
Cool. So when you asked, hey, you know, can I be the instructor? Because clearly you wanted to keep it going because it did something for you. How many classes did you take to feel comfortable enough to ask to teach?
One. So I had taught myself a lot on my own, just kind of playing around. And the chainmail instructor there wasn't specifically a chainmail instructor. She was also, you know, a wire work / beading instructor. So they didn't have anybody that specialized in chainmail. And both of my parents were Chicago public school teachers. So I kind of grew up around education, and I had been a tutor for like high school test prep, SAT, ACT, and was a piano instructor. Even at my summer camp, I had done some like aerobics instruction. So like I knew how to teach, and I feel like that is just as important as the expertise skill level, since you can be great at what you do and also at the same time completely ineffective teaching it if you, you know, don't really know how to teach or have a teaching background. So I don't know, right? Young and bold. I knew that I could teach. That wasn't a problem. And since I knew the weaves that they offered, I knew that I could at least take over what she had done. You know, and I had no idea. I couldn't have envisioned back then that I would wind up inventing my own weaves and, you know, teaching there for I don't know how many years I taught there. It was until they closed. So probably at least like 6 years, maybe eight.
Wow. You know, so you really took like this leap of faith, and your confidence was there. So while you were teaching chainmail, because chainmail is repetition, but sometimes explaining it can be a challenge. And making people feel comfortable enough to work with the pliers and jump rings, because those are the two main things you're working with in any design. How did you, like, what were some things that you learned on the teaching end? Because I'm pretty sure you didn't have, you wasn't all the way prepared, no matter how prepared you were.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, when I first started my first few classes, I didn't have a handout because when I had taken classes, there wasn't a handout. So I didn't realize that was a thing until one of my students asked, like, oh, do we get a handout? And I was like, what? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess photos that they could take home. That would be helpful. And so that's when I started to create tutorials. Another thing is after I had taught a few classes, there was a student who was struggling a little bit. And when I went to help them, I realized, oh, you know what? They're left-handed. And so I'm used to holding the weave with my left hand and manipulating new rings that I'm adding with my right hand. And I realized that with the student, it was reversed. And it had never occurred to me, but, you know, then of course it seems obvious, like, oh yeah. And so then I started creating left-handed instructions where all the photos are reversed. And if you, instead of going from left to right on something, it would go right to left, you know, and so on. And so, you know, I mean, lefties are about 10% of the population. So clearly it's not the majority, but it's easy enough to just flip those photos and, you know, in Photoshop. And that was something really exciting to be able to provide to, you know, to lefties. And then I also learned my early tutorials didn't, they just showed the weave itself. And they didn't show how to attach a clasp. Because once again, for me, that was just something like, oh, sure, you get to the end of the piece, and then you like take a small jump ring and put the clasp on. But realizing that that's not, you know, intuitive to a lot of people. And in order to really have a complete tutorial, it's got to be that like step by step by step, everything there, so that, you know, it's stressful enough when you're learning something new. And so the idea is to take all of that stress away so they can really just enjoy the moment. And so they don't have to try and, you know, invent the wheel or, you know, put things together in a way that just requires too much thought, because that way then they can sit back and once they get into the pattern, just enjoy and know like, hey, this tutorial is going to have everything I need. Everything will be taken care of, all my questions answered. So yeah, those are some of the things I definitely learned from my students.
Nice. That sounds like not only lessons, but growth opportunities for you as well. And, you know, when teaching others, you're also a student at the same time, even though you're leading, you know, the class. So, you know, you got comfortable with teaching. So did you just say, okay, I'm going to make my own supplies, or how did you get into the journey of becoming a supplier?
Well, at first I was, of course, I was buying rings and I was making kits for the class. And then when I taught one of my first classes, I had students ask if they could buy the supplies, and I was like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. And the bead shop didn't sell the entire spectrum. Like, actually, I think at first I was getting the jump rings from the bead shop, but they were nickel and brass and very limited sizes, and you know, the nickel tarnished really quickly. So I wanted to bring in my own supplies from other, you know, suppliers and companies that specialized in chainmail. And the bead store was like, oh yeah, that's fine. And they also said it was fine if I sold them, because they didn't want, like, that's a whole other business model. You know, I mean, it's hard enough to carry so many different sizes and types and colors of beads, let alone to do that all in jump rings. So they said, yeah, just, you know, it's fine if you sell that. So the first day that I brought in still sterling silver, they were actually from Spider Chain, sterling silver jump rings to sell, I sold like $300 worth of supplies. So that's when I was like, oh, maybe there's something here. And that was back when, yeah, I didn't know how to price things or anything. I didn't have a scale. So like to sell, you know, packs of 50 and 100 and 250 was me before class counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so, you know, little by little, that's how it grew. It was like, okay, I'll invest in a scale. And then, you know, as the business grew, you know, then we started sourcing and buying wire, and working primarily with, ring makers in the Chicago area. One of whom had been like my very first intern ever, you know, to coil and cut the rings and then send them off to an anodizer to get the beautiful colors. I don't know what just happened to the sound.
One part, can you repeat that part again? Because I heard you, but it was just a little.
Yeah, let me see.
So you got to the anodizing.
Yeah, are you hearing echo? Because I'm hearing myself echo.
I'm not hearing the echo.
That's weird. Okay. Sorry, I'm just trying to think if I'm able to talk and not be distracted by my echo. Okay, actually now I think it's not echoing anymore, so we should be good. okay, so we started, I'll go back to just talk about when I was buying starting the wire. So as the business grew, then we started to source wire ourselves from a mill in the Midwest in Illinois, so they were local, and work with local people to coil and cut the jump rings, and then send it off to an anodizer to make the beautiful colors for the aluminum. And that's essentially, you know, that was when we were at our peak. You know, we were doing all of that, and we were still sourcing some other rings and components from various other suppliers. But really, we were really proud of the work that we did with the anodizer for our, like, aluminum jump rings, because at the time, nobody really had that, you know, the quality of the anodized jump rings that we did. So that was really great.
Nice. So even though you were supplying your class, did that lead you to form Blue Buddha, or was there some other steps in between on the journey to becoming owner of Blue Buddha Boutique?
So I was Blue Buddha right from the get-go. I officially started that business in February 2003, and you know, and that was when it was just me. I didn't even hire an assistant until 2007. So I started off as Blue Buddha. Interestingly enough, I chose that name because my name, Rebecca Mojica, since I was selling a lot of jewelry as well, and I thought, oh, maybe I'll sell that under my name. But nobody can spell Rebecca, because I spell it with just one C, the Latin way. And my last name is Mojica. Nobody can spell or pronounce that either, apparently. So I was like, oh, Blue Buddha Boutique. You know, that just kind of rolls off the tongue. I like alliteration. And then I later learned nobody knows how to spell Buddha either. So, you know, but yeah, I started off as Blue Buddha because I didn't want chainmail in the title of the business and the name of the business, because I thought that I might go on and do something else. And I didn't want to limit myself to just chainmail. And, you know, little did I know that there was pretty much infinite things to explore in the world of chainmail. And, you know, here I am, you know, what is it, 17 years later, and still with the chainmail.
Yeah. And, you know, the chainmail, at least the jump rings were part of your logo. So it was there, you know, just not spelled out. And Mojica, yeah, there was a radio personality here in Chicago, last name Mojica.
Mojica, yeah.
Mojito, you know, so people probably would have gotten that right, because they could have made the connection with the drink. Calling it the drink, but yeah, you know, if it's something that people are going to have a hard time pronouncing, then too, you know, part of your brand, it has to be something that people can remember too, like, okay, B3 Blue Buddha Boutique, you know. Mm-hmm. So it seems like you had it from the start in terms of formation, and you just didn't know that it was going to broaden, you know, the jewelry making arena, because, you know, you were already making jewelry, and you were going to classes to improve on your techniques, and then you started teaching, and then they say, and then you were including kits with the classes, and then they were like, oh, can you bring some more supplies? And then the store was nice enough to say, you can sell them here. And it was smart, because it drew more customers that probably never shopped there. And then, you know, for you to be able to go ahead and work with other people with, you know, in terms of like the process with the jump rings and so forth. So when Blue Buddha had its storefront, it formed the community from all parts of Chicago and even in other states and countries even. So can you talk about the community aspect of your business? Like, do you feel that you were more than just the chainmail supply lady, or did you feel like, okay, I created the category and there's a real community here and I'm going to expound on the community aspect of it?
Yeah, so I feel like there are multiple communities with Blue Buddha. For sure, the online community, when I started, my website launched in 2004. And then originally I had actually just thought that my students would purchase supplies. So that would help me to not have to lug an entire suitcase full of metal and tools to classes if nobody was going to buy anything. This way I could just bring a much more limited supply and then do pickup orders. But I started to get orders from out of state, and I hadn't expected that. And so that's, that really helped the business take off. And as I hired people, one of the people I hired was a part-time marketing assistant who was, younger than I am and definitely more attuned to what was going on in the world, because we had that conversation back then of like, all right, so we should have a social media presence. And I'm like, Facebook's probably better than MySpace, right? She's like, oh yeah. So, that was a good decision. and so the Facebook community grew to really be our online community. And that was one of the main ways that we engaged with people all across the world. And then having our storefront, we were able to engage with our local community. And our first storefront was in Albany Park, and it was an old dentist office. And we had a front room where there were classes. And, it was great. It was what we needed at the time. But we quickly outgrew it, and we wound up needing the front room for storage and all sorts of things. So that's when we moved to the much larger facility in Edgewater. And because we were moving to the larger facility, that's when I really wanted to embrace that local community. Not only the residents there, but also the artisans, and to just really have like a creative center. And so not only were we offering classes, but we had an artisan market featuring predominantly locally made. There were some, out of state folks, but almost everybody was, in the Midwest, gift cards and pottery and clothing and jewelry, chocolate. I mean, it was really great and amazing. The work that was there was great. And I just really, I wanted to bring that to the community and, have people appreciate that they could shop local and, shop, for me, being able to buy something that was handmade by someone or conceived by someone and not available on a big commercial, scale is really special. And I think it makes the product, the good, really special when there's that meaning behind it. And and then I was also part of the Chicago Craft Mafia. And as a member of the Craft Mafia, we did free workshops for crafters, and we hosted a lot of them at Blue Buddha, because once we were there, we're like, we have this great big space, this is perfect. So things like, how to price your work, how to market your work, how to, build an Etsy shop, how to have a website. So all sorts of different topics. Every quarter we would get together, and those were really well attended, and it was a great service to provide because these were all free for the artists to attend. And then we also did the DIY trunk show, which had been started by one of the members of the Craft Mafia, and then the Craft Mafia took it over, and then Blue Buddha took it over. And so that was a craft fair with 100 to 150 artisans, 5 to 8,000 people attending. and a great holiday show. It was so much work. For not a lot of money, because we were trying to do it in a way to give the artists exposure and not really make money off of it, but just to, you know, give local people a place to shop and artists a place to sell. But, you know, the whole don't make money off of it is at the end what really made us think, oh, we can't, you know, keep going down this path and, you know, and doing this. But yeah, all of those things I, you know, think were really great ways to engage the community in many different ways, but all coming back to just the importance of, you know, making something with your own two hands or buying something from someone who has that, you know, maker connection to it. So that, like I said, the items just have a lot of meaning and are all really special.
Beautiful. I remember the Chicago Craft Mafia, and hearing it more in depth, it's like, wow, you know, it went beyond just being in the community to actually pouring into the community, whether arts and or non-arts. And it was just a great way for people to remember Blue Buddha. You know, even if they never bought any jump rings, right? You know, but someone would come past and would say, oh, they have this workshop or this training. But what I want to ask you, Rebecca, is you said, you know, you wanted to pour in and you did these things, but then it came to a point where, okay, it's not about the money, but it's bleeding money. So how did you balance your passion, your heart, and your soul? Because a lot of entrepreneurs, they can't get over that hurdle. And it might be someone listening to the podcast that is a little bit attached to what they really believe in and what they really want versus doing what's right from a business standpoint. So how, like, we know how you got, I mean, like, you got to the conclusion, but once you got to the conclusion, did you feel that you had a responsibility to stay true to what you believed in? Or did you say, okay, from another standpoint, if I keep doing this, I'm going to be out of business?
So I do believe in staying true to what you believe in. I mean, for me personally, I would feel like a fraud. I could not be happy and therefore be healthy doing something, anything less than my true authentic self. I actually had a coach say that to me once, because I'm a very honest person with many things. And she was like, wow, she's like, Rebecca, you can't be anything less than your authentic self, can you? And I was like, nope. And so, you know, for us, when it came down to it with the business, you know, it became clear that Blue Buddha sales, which had been increasing and increasing and increasing for years, began to plateau. And our expenses had gone up. You know, we invested heavily in moving to a larger facility, anticipating that sales would continue to go up, and they did not. And then several of our suppliers, you know, our anodizer doubled their prices on most things. You know, so that really made it difficult, because we're like, well, we can't double our prices to the consumer. So now we have to, you know, there was a lot going on, and there were a lot of manufacturing issues. We were spending so much time troubleshooting those, you know, and that was, you know, that was a big issue. And so, you know, when I looked at the numbers and saw that, you know, we'll get, it was that toward the end of the year, I'm like, we'll get through the holiday season just fine. But typically January, February, March are not big sales months. And I could tell, I was like, we're going to run out of money. And we'd been trying and fighting for so long. I had talked to, I don't know how many, you know, different consultants, many of whom had come in for free. Like I won a grant from, you know, a nonprofit that helps with like turnaround management. And, you know, pretty much everyone came in and was like, yeah, you're doing everything that we would suggest. So it just was clear that, you know, how we were set up, it wasn't going to work. And so, you know, that's when I made the decision to shut down. And as you'll know, as probably a lot of the people, you know, listening to this, if they know anything about Blue Buddha, know that I'm still around. So even though I shut down the business in 2016, chainmail, that is my true authentic self. And, you know, I kept up the PDFs on Etsy, just because at the beginning I was like, well, you know, that's a couple bucks here in my pocket. So, you know, let's keep that revenue stream going. But then, you know, I wanted to still make jewelry and sell designs. And so even though I've, you know, kind of tried out a few other things in the meantime, chainmail has still been where my heart is and my passion is. And, you know, now I'm back to full-time working on chainmail and, you know, planning more kits to release and just getting back into that. And this time approaching it, you know, in a different way. And, you know, I don't want to take on the manufacturing, you know, compared to when we started, there are actually now many manufacturers of chainmail. Well, I shouldn't say many, but there are enough that are high quality. And so that gap that I had tried to fill in earlier is filled. And so that's not something that I need to tackle and solve. And that makes me very happy because what I am good at is teaching people how to make chainmail. I am good at putting colors together in ways that really evoke excitement and emotion. And so I can create kits that do that. I can create finished pieces and, you know, artwork, almost wearable art, that is all aligned with who I am and what I love to do. And I don't need to spend my time being upset that the wire tolerance is, you know, 0.02, you know, millimeters off. Therefore, the design doesn't work because of this or that, you know. You know, now there are people, other companies who are dealing with that. And if I buy something and it doesn't work, I could yell at them and then get my money back and then everything's fine. And I'm not trying to like deal with fixing all of that. So I've just tried to take out a lot of the labor that I do not enjoy, that I'm not good at, and focus on what I am good at. And really just, you know, I've parsed the business down. I'm no longer trying to say yes to things that don't excite me. Or if somebody messages and they want something, and I just realize, oh, I could do it, but it's like, financially, money-wise, it's going to take me an hour to like do this, and I'm going to wind up with like $5. So no, I'm not going to do that. So I just look at opportunities in a different way, I think, now.
Yeah, and it's good to see that you're in a space where not only do you recognize what you're good at, I agree, you're very great with teaching, and you can most certainly put color combinations together. Like, when I saw a lot of your mixes, I was like, oh, wow, I never, you know, kind of thought that would have went together. And it made me, you know, go back and look at the color wheel and be like, oh, okay, this is hues, tint, and shade. So it does go, you know, it's just like a pow color, because you like to have a bold color mixed in with like a little bit of a shade or a tinted color. That's usually kind of how you mix your jump rings. And so, you know, not only that, but that helped feminize chainmail, you know, instead of, you know, saying, okay, we can only choose the stainless steel or the aluminum or the brass. You know, not every woman wants to wear those models. Like, you know, we want to, you know, have some color too. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you, as you were pouring into other people, right, did you ever feel like you would be grooming them to like take you out or to be like your sole competitor? Or did you feel like, okay, I'm doing this from the heart and I'm going to walk in abundance?
I've mostly thought of it as coming from a place of abundance, for sure. I did have a friend at some point, you know, 15 years ago or so, say to me like, hey, so you're, by teaching people how to do this, you're really creating your competition, don't you think? And a little bit of competition, sure, for my finished jewelry, because when I first started doing jewelry shows in the Midwest, I was one of the only chain mailers. Melissa Banks from Wrapped in Mail was around before I was. And, you know, so she had been around, and there were maybe one or two folks out in the suburbs doing sterling silver precious metals work with chain mail. But I was the first one in Chicago to especially work with tons of color, you know, and some of the, you know, new designs that I created. But then teaching people, yes, then all of a sudden now, you know, doing shows, there would be more and more people who were chain mailers, who were my students. And so that was certainly challenging and interesting. And it definitely forced me to stay at the top of my game, because what I realized at one point, you know, there was somebody who came up to me at a show, you know, a patron, and she said, hey, I bought this necklace from you at blah, blah, blah show, you know, and it broke. And I was like, oh no. And then I was like, well, wait a minute, blah, blah, blah show. I wasn't at that show. You know, are you sure? And, you know, she's pointing the design, and it's a design that I make and sell, but also I would teach and sell that. And then it occurred to me, I was like, oh, she must have gotten it from one of my students. And, you know, and so that, then I realized, okay, well, that's a problem. If they, you know, can't tell, if a customer can't tell the difference between my work, you know, and someone else's. And so that's when I decided to really, to try and create a few, like one of a kind, really high end show pieces, and to create some pieces in my work that I don't teach people how to do, so that, you know, my work can still have a unique aspect to it. And I hate that word unique, but it, you know, it really is what I wanted, is to make sure that my work would stand out. But other than that, I mean, I thought it was great that there were more people out in the world doing chainmail, because that raises awareness about the craft. And you know, it's a very time consuming craft. So when people come up and are like, well, wait, why does that bracelet cost like $85? And you know, because they don't realize that that bracelet takes more than an hour to make, you know, and there's material costs involved. If you sell through another retail shop, or a gallery, they're going to take anywhere from 40% to 60%. So, you know, that there's a reason why things are priced the way they are. But knowing that time behind it, you know, because when I also first started, there were a lot of people who thought like, I just bought these chains and stuck a clasp on it. And so, you know, just being able to raise awareness about this art form, I thought was really powerful. And that's a great way to do it, is by teaching people how to do it. And then that cycle continues because they teach other people. And when I first got into chainmail, one of the very first things I attended about 6 months after I had started was a quote unquote chainmail gathering down in Missouri, held at the house of somebody who used to be a chainmail supplier. And there were like 30 mailers from all over the United States who came for this weekend of mailing. And everybody just taught everybody else what they knew. That was where I learned half Persian 3-in-1. Somebody just sat down and taught me. Somebody showed me how to permanently close a 6-in-1 ring in on itself, so that it was seamless. And a finger ring, I mean, that was such an amazing experience. And I just felt like I needed to pay it forward, and just kind of keep that cycle of teacher and student going.
That's great. Like, I wish it was something like that here in Chicago, like a mini weekend where you said, with other jewelry makers, and, you know, we can teach one another some techniques or give some tips, or, you know, because I believe in, I believe when you build around you, you go much further than going after someone who is already there and then saying, give me, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just sounds like that you really built with the people you already have relationships with, and you didn't try to chase what was on the higher end in the chainmail world, because there are some big players, you know, but you didn't go and chase that. You really built that. And that goes back to that community thing. But what I also want, I forgot to ask you earlier, is when you knew, okay, in a matter of X amount of months, I'm going to run out of money, how did you prepare? Because that ties into what's going on now, you know, in this pandemic, companies are laying off employees, some are terminating them to keep from paying. How did you mentally prepare and emotionally prepare for yourself? And then how did you prepare your staff to deal with this new reality as well?
Well, I'm not going to lie, that was a pretty dark time in my life. And I certainly did a lot of crying. When I realized that I was going to run out of money and I knew I was going to lay people off, like I said, it was toward the end of the year. And so the question that I was wondering is, well, do I tell the staff now? Do I, you know, is that going to spoil everyone's holiday? Do I wait till the new year? And I asked a close group of friends, you know, what they thought, because I could see pros and cons of, you know, both. And almost unanimously, my friends said, tell people now, because they are going to be making decisions on how to spend their money for holiday gifts. And if they know that they're not going to have money at some point, they may make different decisions, you know. And so I was like, okay, that totally makes sense to me. And so I told my staff, you know, much earlier than we told the public. And I'm a planner by nature. And so I knew when we were able to break our lease, you know, and my deepest gratitude to the landlady for letting us get out of our lease and not holding us to like an additional 2 years of rent. So I knew when our closing date would be, and, you know, from there I was able to backtrack, like, okay, let's close the retail store, you know, about 2 months before that, so we can clear out all of the retail stuff, and then, you know, we'll still have the warehouse going for a while. This will be our last day of online sales. So then I figured out what staff we needed. And so I was able to, you know, in the middle of December, you know, sit our staff down. It was not a surprise to them, because we were doing open book management. So there's a whole philosophy, and there's a company, The Great Game of Business, that we were following. And so every week we would get together and share the financial numbers, as well as a few other metrics. And so everybody in the company knew what our financial position was. So it certainly was, you know, it was not a shock to them. And everybody was very saddened, of course, you know, and so I essentially let them know, this is what's happening. These are when everybody's last dates are going to be, or I actually think I said, you know, I would talk to people individually. I looking back now, I don't remember exactly how I did it, but I wanted it to be very clear so that there wasn't additional anxiety of like, oh my gosh, am I here for 2 weeks or for 2 months? And I let the employees know that even if they were scheduled to be on until the end, but they found a job before that, because I certainly expected and encouraged them to go out and look for a job. You know, they could leave before that. You know, I wanted them to, you know, feel like they had agency over their own lives and, you know, wouldn't have to turn down an opportunity. And, you know, and then I think I was like, okay, we can be done for the day. You know, we can have a beer and chocolate and just, you know, relax and let's process this and talk about it. Anybody who wants to talk about it. And I'm almost tearing up thinking about this because my team was so amazing and so sweet. You know, I knew that this was, this conversation was very difficult for me to have. And I knew from having laid people off actually a couple of years prior, to not make it about me at all, because at this point, you know, all of the employees, like it's their livelihood that is in jeopardy, right? If they're not going to be making money, that immediately threatens food and shelter, which are human basic needs. And so if a boss at that point says like, oh, this is just as hard for me as it is for you, like that's a terrible thing to say. You know, have compassion for your employees and what you're doing to them. So even though it was very difficult for me, I was really just trying to be as supportive to them as possible, because I have other people that I can, you know, cry on and get support from. But they went for a walk, you know, some of them did. And then I was maybe in a meeting with somebody else or whatever, but at some point I came back to my desk later that day, and they had bought me a chocolate chip cookie from Whole Foods and had written a really sweet note on it, with a happy face, you know, and they're just like, you know, hang in there. Or like, I don't even remember what it said. But I totally started bawling, 'cause I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that at this very moment when they've been told that the company is closing and they're all losing their jobs, they went and bought me a cookie. Like, I mean, it was amazing. And, you know, and I think that's a real testament to the culture that we had. And, you know, it was definitely a culture that I was very purposeful about building and attracting great people. But that, you know, that was one of the big successes of Blue Buddha, I think, is, you know, people.
Yeah. I believe that, you know, the culture was really strong at Blue Buddha, because no matter when people came there, whether it was for a class or to just browse around or to, you know, make a purchase, your staff was always there to help, like genuinely help. And their level of expertise, their knowledge, the kindness, it was as if you were there. So, and a lot of times you wasn't there because you were at shows and things like that. But to create a culture that can function as if you are there, that says a lot about the systems that you created and the tone that you set. So you did a very great job for that. And it's not surprising that they were still thoughtful of you in spite of them no longer having a job in months to come. And, you know, to tell somebody that they're no longer going to be employed, you really have to be careful with the way it's communicated. And it might did hurt you as much as it hurted them, but it just wasn't the time or the place to say that. And to have that ethics to, and that support, you know, your friends to say, you need to tell them now. And that, you know, that was a great answer that they gave you. And how many employees did you have?
That's a great question. I'm not sure how many we had by the very end. Maybe we had 12, 16. Most of them were part-time. We had a lot of artists and creative people that would work with us. And so they would maybe just come in for a few hours a week, even some of them. But yeah, we, at our peak, I know we had 18, but I don't think we were at 18 by the time we were closing down.
Okay. So we're getting closer to wrapping this up. This has been very good so far. So what advice would you have for listeners that are either new to jewelry making, curious about making jewelry, already making jewelry, looking to go to the next level, maybe start a business of handmade jewelry or on the supplier side? What advice Oh.
All right, so that's a lot of different scenarios, and it may be hard to have advice that covers all of it, but maybe one thing would be just the idea of persistence. You know, if somebody's like, oh, I'm a beginner jewelry maker, you know, a lot of people seem very hesitant or not very confident, and that's totally to be expected. You know, it of course, when you're just starting, you know, you're not going to be the greatest artist in the world. You know, it's really about the joy and making sure that you're enjoying what you're doing and giving yourself permission to fail, because in order to succeed, you will likely have to fail many, many times. And so whether that's failing in a creative way by trying something, you know, jewelry wise and it doesn't work, and you try something else and it doesn't work, or also in business, trying something and it doesn't work. Just knowing that if you still have that end goal and that vision that you are tracing, that you just keep at it, you know, and you can see from, you know, from me, I built a huge business up and then closed it all down. And, you know, and to some ways, sure, that is a failure. And what did I do? I learned from that and I kept going, you know, and I'm still enjoying what I'm doing. And so, yeah, I think that's really the main thing is just do it many times and enjoy it.
Awesome. So just briefly talk about your journey and your experience when you walked away from Blue Buddha, and then you start doing QVC, you start getting into the toy arena, which is totally different.
Yeah, it's a whole different world for sure. There was a woman who was on my advisory board for many years at Blue Buddha. I say for many years, actually, I think it was a year and a half. It was a program I went through, Athena PowerLink program, where they set female entrepreneurs up with an advisory board. And that was an amazing experience. But she was on my advisory board to give advice about manufacturing, since she was with a toy manufacturing company. And so she had contacted me saying, hey, I really want to do something like chainmail for kids. And we had talked about it when she had been on my advisory board, which at this point was a few years prior. And I was like, oh man, chainmail for adults is sometimes hard enough, like chainmail for kids. But they were really determined this time. And since I knew Blue Buddha was closing, I was like, oh, this is how much more perfect can you get, where one door closes, another door opens. And so we met and sat down and had a few brainstorming sessions. And that is how Linked Craft Kits were born. I believe we released 9 different projects. There were 5 in the first round and 4 in the second round. And that was an incredible experience because I got to work with some brilliant minds, especially like from an engineering standpoint, to work out like, hey, let's create some new tools for this. And Nadja Aller, who had worked at Blue Buddha and was my right-hand woman for many years and there till the bitter end. And actually she was even there a few days after I was gone, because I moved to California and she was there the last 2 days, you know, tying up all the loose ends. She helped with the toy company folks for a while too, to create tools, to foam tools to hold the jump rings, so that the kids could add them with their fingers, and they would manipulate the rings with their fingers. The engineers went to China and helped develop a special alloy of aluminum where you can bend it back and forth like a zillion, so it's soft enough you can bend it with your fingers. You can bend it back a zillion times and it's not going to break. And so the kids would bend these with their fingers and then put it in the foam tool so it would hold its place, and therefore you don't need pliers. And yeah, so Nadja helped to develop those tools. And yeah, I mean, it was an amazing experience. It was also very new because that was my first foray into the toy industry. And, you know, learning like, oh, right, these are for children. So there's a whole bunch of safety protocols and safety regulations that have to be followed. You know, everything has to be tested. You know, that just adds an extra added layer of expense. And this is also how we got into QVC, you know, was through the toy company and this opportunity. And it's also, I mean, I'll be honest that there's a lot about the toy industry that is amazing. Like, I'm a gamer. I love tabletop gaming. And, you know, I'm a big nerd. So I love the idea of like, oh my God, games. And, you know, I'm going to go to like a toy fair and it's going to be amazing. The toy industry is also the most competitive industry that I've had like direct experience with. I mean, it is so cutthroat because everyone is just, I mean, they're kind of like snakes. It's like they're just out looking for the next big thing, and they want to steal it from someone if they think somebody else is doing it. And you go to the trade show and there's big, huge walls up everywhere because the manufacturers don't want anybody, any other manufacturers to see what they're working on. And so you can only get into their booth if you're a retail person. And so that was just very different from what I was used to in the chainmail world of like, let's share everything. And so yeah, that was intense. And that was definitely not something I enjoyed. But yeah, so we did that for a few years. Unfortunately the toy company went out of business, which is why, you know, we shut down. But in its very short life, I'm trying to think how many awards we won. I mean, we won a ton of industry awards. So, you know, in such a short time, we had a lot of recognition. And that was great. I would still, you know, love to find an opportunity to, you know, work with another company who wants to license it or to kind of, you know, take it to a whole new level.
Wow. I'm familiar with the toy and game fair, like the big one that's in New York City in February, I believe. I've never attended that, but I have attended the toy and game fair here in Chicago. And you know, it's highly competitive. You're correct. You just see it at the shows. And I haven't saw it at the magnitude in which you describe, but I can attest to the competitiveness. Everyone's looking for their next big thing, as you spoke. And I'm sure that did, you know, it was like going from one end of the spectrum where it was free, open, caring, giving, sharing, to the other end of the spectrum where, okay, let me keep a closed fist, you know? So I can imagine that, but wow, I mean, what a journey, like from Germany to Chicago to LA to, you know, student making, teaching, supplying, building communities, building a mafia, post Blue Buddha, you know, doing with the, you know, QVC, sorry about that, and the toy industry, tackling it on, you know, and winning, you know, industry awards. Like, you have really lived a legacy. And I want to say that while you are still living. So, believe in giving you your flowers, people flowers while they still here to smell them. So Rebecca, where can people who are listening that are intrigued and inspired by your story that you shared today, where can they buy? Is there a website, and are you on social media where they can follow, like, and share and tag you?
Yes. I will list a few websites, social media. The easiest thing to do is probably to search for Blue Buddha Boutique, it's B-U-D-D-H-A, or Rebecca Mojica, Rebecca with one C, R-E-B-E-C-A, Mojica, M-O-J-I-C-A. So for my finished jewelry, there's RebeccaMojica.com. I also have an Etsy shop, and I'm giving my website a facelift over the next couple months, so that's exciting. And then for supplies, Blue Buddha Boutique right now has an Etsy shop. At some point, I'll probably have a website as well. I mean, there is a website, you just can't buy anything. It's sort of archived information, and the blog is there. And social media, mostly Blue Buddha is on Facebook, though I'll be reactivating Instagram, and that's Blue Buddha BTQ, I think on Instagram, or it might be Blue Buddha Boutique, actually. Blue Buddha BTQ is our Twitter. And then Rebecca Mojica Jewelry on Instagram for my finished jewelry.
Wonderful. And listeners, ladies and gentlemen, I know Rebecca gave a lot of links, pages. So in the description of today's podcast, all of the links will be listed. So that way you can go directly to the pages that you're interested in. Rebecca, wow, what can I say? Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing your journey with the listeners. Thank you for the pearls of wisdom that you gave to listeners. And for, you know, those who have listened, please, you know, take some of those golden nuggets, because she dropped some gems in this interview today. And Rebecca is like a flower, you know, peeling off flowers. You know, time you think you're at the bottom of the layer, there's another layer there that we just don't know. So she's been a mentor of mine for almost a year, and it's just been great working with her, and to have her to come on and to give you all a piece of herself and to share her journey, her passion, her ups and her downs is just absolutely remarkable. So Rebecca, thank you so much for doing this, and it was great to have you here.
Thank you so much. This has been really great. And thanks for all your very thoughtful questions.
Yep. So
to learn more about Crafty Hands Club, please visit our website, www.craftyhandsclub.com. Thank you for listening to the Crafty Hands Club podcast. Come back and join us next week.